to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the groups Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange, who discusses the role of the peace movement in relation to the deepening quagmire for the United States in Afghanistan. Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who talks about the public policy implications of the Garrido abduction case. And Dr. Carol Harris, a psychiatrist and member of Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses where the national health care reform debate may be headed after the August congressional recess. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Afghanistan, currently the world's biggest supplier of opium, will soon face a stepped-up drug eradication campaign with more funding for alternative crops like wheat. But critics say a tough anti-narcotics campaign will alienate rural farmers and boost the Taliban insurgency. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration is planning to hike the number of agents in Afghanistan by sixfold in 2009. The Pentagon has also targeted the top 50 drug traffickers who have ties to the Taliban. The new strategy in Afghanistan borrows some tactics from anti-drug policies in Colombia. According to the Christian Science Monitor, drug eradication efforts in Colombia helped undermine the Cali and Medellin cartels, but opened the door for drug trafficking by the Rebel Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. At the June G8 summit in Italy, Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, remarked to reporters that previous drug eradication efforts had driven farmers into the hands of the Taliban. Colombia drug policy advisor Ricardo Vargas observed, "The Taliban may be more capable of mobilizing resistance to drug eradication efforts than the FARC because it has the resources to offer farmers credit and other assistance programs." During the financial meltdown last fall, the nation's biggest banks got billions of dollars in bailout money out of a fear these global mega banks were too big to fail. A year since the meltdown, spurred by the failure of Lehman Brothers, these big banks have just gotten bigger and more powerful, taking market share away from smaller regional and community banks who continue to struggle during the long recession. According to the Washington Post, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America combined hold nearly a third of all bank deposits in the United States. With this increased clout, big banks increased consumer fees by 8% in the first quarter of 2009. In response, smaller banks cut their fees to stay competitive. The Obama administration has proposed an overhaul of financial regulations that would require higher capital standards for big banks and create a new Consumer Finance Protection Board. Now, banks are lobbying vigorously to kill the financial reform package. For a brief moment, workers at Chicago's Republic Windows and Doors captured the nation's attention with a six-day sit-in last December. With the backing of their international union, the United Electrical Workers, or UE, these 250 workers put intense pressure on the company and their bank, Bank of America, to pay back wages after the company closed its doors. During the most intense recession in 60 years, there are few signs of a new wave of worker sit-ins to protect jobs from layoffs. According to the news magazine In These Times, American workers continue to blame themselves and not management for layoffs and plant closings. Workers continue to accept longer working hours to try to save their jobs. A notable exception was the vote by workers at Hart, Schaffner & Marx, the men's clothing maker, to stage a sit-in against the company and its bank, Wells Fargo, if they failed to find a buyer to keep the company's American factories open. In June, Hart Max sold its factories to the firm Emerisk. In contrast, workers in Europe and Latin America have a history of taking direct action to save their jobs. For example, British energy workers recently staged an unauthorized national strike to preserve jobs. Since the PATCO strike in the early 1980s, American unions have acted defensively and stayed away from militant actions in good times and bad, as the right to collectively organize has deteriorated. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
As Afghanistan attempts to put the best face on their August 20th presidential election, tainted by widespread charges of fraud and vote rigging on behalf of Afghanistan's incumbent president, Hamid Karzai, General Stanley McChrystal, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, has issued a report on the progress of the eight-year war. General McChrystal, after releasing his report to the Pentagon, said in a statement that the situation in Afghanistan is serious, but success is achievable and demands a revised implementation strategy, commitment and resolve, and increased unity of effort. August has been the most deadly month yet for U.S. forces fighting in Afghanistan, with 51 dead. A total of 800 U.S. servicemen and women have been killed since the American invasion and overthrow of the Islamic fundamentalist Taliban government in October 2001, following the September 11th terrorist attacks. Since taking office, President Obama has sent an additional 21,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan for a total of 68,000 in country. But there is speculation that thousands more troops may soon be deployed. According to a new CNN opinion research poll released on September 1st, 57% of Americans surveyed say they oppose the U.S. war in Afghanistan, with 42% supporting the military mission. The percentage of those in opposition to the war is up 11 points since April. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who discusses the role of the peace movement in relation to what appears to be a deepening quagmire for the United States in Afghanistan.
Obama has already sent an additional 20,000 troops to Afghanistan. The total of U.S. troops is now, well, will be 68,000 by the end of the year. There's about 100,000 troops that NATO has committed. And where is this all leading? The situation in Afghanistan is getting no better, as McChrystal will say. And to call for more troops is just like the case of Vietnam, widening the war without a real plan. And nobody can clearly articulate to the American people what it is we're even trying to do in Afghanistan. We've had other generals like Petraeus say that there is no military solution, that we should have an 80-20 formula where 80% is political and economic focus and 20% military, and yet they're just passing new supplemental bills for war in Afghanistan that are 95% military. So we're pursuing a military strategy when we should be putting money into the uplifting people out of poverty. If we want to protect anything, we should be protecting girls' schools, and there could be international peacekeepers that do that. But there is no military solution, and this could unfortunately be the unraveling of a progressive agenda.
When it comes to the idea of negotiating with the Taliban, Medea, there's a lot of mixed feelings here and around the world. The Taliban, of course, were a very repressive regime when they were in power, repressing women particularly and those who didn't adhere to their brand of fundamental Islam. Do you think negotiating a political solution to the war in Afghanistan with the Taliban is a viable option?
I think there's different factions of the Taliban, just as there's different factions of the Democratic and Republican parties, and we have to have talks with the more moderate factions of the Taliban. Unfortunately, now we have all kinds of warlords and murderers and drug dealers that are within the government of Hamid Karzai, a very corrupt government, but also many regressive people in there who don't respect the rights of women, and they're part of the government we're supporting. We have to support women's organizations inside Afghanistan. We have to support girls' schools. We have to support economic projects that are aimed at women. There's all kinds of things that we can be doing to decrease the strength of the worst elements of the Taliban and increase the strength of the victims of the Taliban, such as women's rights. But doing it through a military bombing campaign and drones and the constant killing of civilians is only adding fuel to the fire, is only creating more recruits for the Taliban and even for Al-Qaeda, and is not going to end the cycle of violence.
Where is the U.S. peace movement in all this? It seems that since the election of Barack Obama, a lot of the opposition to Bush administration policies in both Iraq and Afghanistan have really seen a lower profile. Is it the fact that many in the peace movement see the Democrats as a better alternative to the previous Bush administration, therefore they're giving Barack Obama a pass here? What do you think?
There's a lot of different things going on, Scott. At the level of Congress, I think, yes, they're reluctant to take on the Obama administration, which still has a lot of popularity out there. Within the peace movement on the grassroots level, people are tired from so many years of protesting and organizing and mobilizing and vigils and rallies and phone calls and emails. It's exhausting. And they would like to trust Obama to do the right thing. In the case of Iraq, people are anxious that he stick to a timeline that he promised. And then there's economic factors as well. We've had a Code Pink House in D.C. that in the past has been overflowing with people coming to stay at the house and join us on our forays into the Capitol and at the White House to lobby for an end to the war. And now it's harder to get people because they have a difficult time finding the financial resources to come to Washington, D.C. If they have jobs, they're afraid to take time off from their jobs. So that has impacted us as well. So I think there's a combination of things. But I do feel that this is the time that we'll start seeing an upsurge in the movement against the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. Once you see public opinion turn around, we've had now 6 months of the Obama administration. I think people are feeling a little more comfortable about challenging the administration's positions, particularly on Afghanistan.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the groups Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. Contact Code Pink by calling area code 415-575-5555 or visit their website at codepinkalert.org. In late August, J.C. Dugard, who had been kidnapped as an 11-year-old in California 18 years ago, was freed from her captors, along with the two daughters her kidnapper, Philip Garrido, had fathered. Garrido and his wife had been charged with 29 counts of kidnapping and rape. Because this is one of the nation's most sensational kidnapping cases, it could derail significant prison reform legislation that has already passed the California Senate and is pending in the House. The bill calls for reducing the state's prison population by 27,000 through an early parole program for nonviolent offenders, with a goal of reducing California's ballooning budget deficit by $1.2 billion. The bill, if passed, would allow correction officials to focus on the truly violent, dangerous criminals in the system, such as Philip Garrido, who was a convicted rapist and served 11 years in prison before he was paroled and later kidnapped J.C. Dugard. Yet some legislators are using this case to oppose releasing any prisoners before their sentences are complete, even nonviolent offenders. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, a group that promotes evidence-based approaches to public safety. He talks about the possible impact the Garrido case could have on public policy and what some other states are doing to address prison overcrowding, public safety, and their budget crises.
Well, our situation now is that the United States has a world record level of incarceration. We have six times as many people locked up in our prisons and jails as we did back in 1970. And of the 2.3 million people in prison jail, more than half of them are locked up for a nonviolent drug or property offense. People are being kept in prison for longer and longer periods of time. And the cost of this, of course, is very substantial. Currently, something like $60 billion a year annually for the cost of corrections.
If some of the nonviolent offenders could be paroled early, can you explain how you think that would impact public safety and also public expenditures?
Well, currently, of all the corrections dollars we spend, about 90% goes to incarceration and just 10% to community supervision under probation or parole. The problem is then that most offenders, you know, are going to be in the community at some point, and the more resources we invest in prison, the less we have available for supervising people in the community. So if we want to stay on top of people who've been convicted of a sex offense or a serious violent offense and are now in the community, we need to do something to shift those resources so parole officers don't have high caseloads, so they can get the proper training, the proper kind of supervision techniques. And unless we can shift those resources, then we're always sort of working behind. We're putting a higher risk on having people in the community than needs to be the case. And the problem is, you know, 95% of the people who go to prison are getting out someday. And the question is, how do we supervise those people once they're in the community? It's not a question of if they'll get out. It's a question of when they'll get out and what we do about it.
For somebody who's already a sex offender, there are registries where people can see who's on it and where they live. I think most sex offenders are not really cured after serving time in prison, so it's important to keep tabs on them. But are you aware of any states that provide more effective treatment?
The problem in sex offenders is that it's a complicated issue, of course. First of all, we have a broad range of offenses that go under that term, anywhere from peeping Toms on one end to serial rapists on the other end, and lots of behaviors in between. So first of all, it's important to distinguish among them, because for some of these behaviors, there's been good behavioral therapy to control the persistence of these behaviors. For others, it's more difficult to do so. So we need to supervise appropriately. Most of that is going to have to come from law enforcement and parole officers. You know, when we put names of sex offenders on registries, it makes people in the public feel better in some ways. The problem is that can often be a false perception. You know, 90% of people engaging in sex offenses are doing it, you know, within the confines of the home or the family, and unfortunately most of those cases never come to light with the public.
Mark Maurer, aside from sex offenders specifically, are you aware of any states that are handling violent offenders versus nonviolent offenders, many of whom are drug abusers, in a way that provides better alternatives for nonviolent offenders, and then the states could have more resources available to deal with really dangerous criminals?
Well, a number of states are starting to make some better distinctions about who's incarcerated, who's on parole. States like North Carolina and Minnesota have tried to put more emphasis on using prison for more serious offenders and keeping less serious offenders in a community setting with appropriate resources. Other states are trying to manage their parole populations more effectively as well. So in recent years, the state of Kansas been concerned they were sending back to prison lots of people convicted of technical violations of parole. In other words, they might have failed to report to a parole officer, had a dirty urine when they did a drug test. They're not ignoring those, but they're saying, you know, how can we intervene, put either greater supervision on the person or add greater resources so we don't have to send them back to incarceration at $25,000 a year. So by using community resources, by training parole officers, by reducing caseloads, they're having good success in keeping people away from incarceration while addressing public safety, too.
The Philip Garrido case may sidetrack efforts at prison reform in California, despite the tremendous human and financial costs of incarcerating thousands of nonviolent offenders. But do you think the fiscal crisis around the country is actually going to lead inevitably to a reduction in the prison population?
The fiscal crisis is really driving some policymakers to do what should be done whether or not there's a fiscal crisis, and that is, you know, rely on evidence-based approaches to public safety and ones that don't make the problem worse. So some state governors are receptive this, some are not, but, you know, I think increasingly the fiscal crisis is going to be calling this to attention in virtually every state.
That was Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project. Call the project at area code 202-628-0871 or visit their website at sentencingproject.org. The death of Ted Kennedy, the U.S. Senate's most passionate and powerful advocate of universal health care, has rallied some in Congress and around the nation to redouble their efforts to pass comprehensive health care reform legislation this year. But one key member of the Senate Finance Committee, Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, says that the establishment of a government-run health insurance option will not be part of the final package. Senator Grassley is one of three Republicans and three Democrats working to negotiate a bipartisan bill. On the other side, Richard Trumka, AFL-CIO Secretary-Treasurer and presumed next president of the Union Federation, warned that legislators who abandon a public option in health reform legislation would pay a high price. Trumka, who recently spoke at the Center for American Progress, said, "I think they need to understand that you can have a bill that guarantees quality, affordable health care for every American, or you can have a bill that Republicans will vote for, but you can't have both." Dr. Carol Paris, a psychiatrist from Maryland, is an active member of Physicians for a National Health Program, a group that advocates single-payer health care, a system employed by most industrialized nations around the world to cover all their citizens. Dr. Paris was arrested along with seven others at a May 5th Senate Finance Committee hearing after she stood up to demand that Finance Chair Senator Max Baucus allow for a full debate of the single-payer option. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Paris, who assesses where the national health care reform debate may be headed after the August congressional recess.
I'm certainly not a pundit, but my take on it is that the amount of money that's being spent by the so-called stakeholders, $1.4 million a day, that's the amount of money that they're putting in to Washington, D.C. to make sure that really no substantive reform takes place, and especially not a public option. I think they're going to be successful at blocking that, and I think that either we're going to see nothing happen, nothing will pass, possibly we will unfortunately pass a very watered-down bill that has triggers or co-ops instead of a robust Medicaid-based public option. And I haven't given up on the hope that when the Wiener Amendment comes to a floor vote, we'll have single-payer.
So you still have hope?
I do indeed. I'm a psychiatrist, so you have to give me a little leeway here. I spend my whole life, professional life, working with people, and I know that people can change their minds, that they can look quietly inside themselves and have a moment of enlightenment and realize and change their thinking drastically.
Dr. Paris, there's been a lot of criticisms of government health care, despite the fact that Medicare has been so successful and many senior citizens would never trade it away. But the idea of a public option here in this current debate over health care reform, there's a lot of hesitance to go in for another big government program. And as an antidote to that, many conservative Democrats and others are pushing the idea of co-ops, cooperatives, regional cooperatives. What's the relative comparison between a federal public government insurance option versus co-ops?
Well, if we look at history, they tried co-ops back in the 30s during the Depression, and in spite of a great deal of government subsidies initially, they failed. Most co-ops never reach a sufficient size to become financially viable or to deal with just market fluctuations. The health analysts, the experts, suggest that you need at least 500,000 people enrolled in a plan in order for it to be financially viable. And one of those plans, the Group Health Cooperative in Washington State, currently has 600,000 members and is a pretty effective plan, but it took them 62 years to reach that enrollment. I don't think we have 62 years to wait for co-ops to become viable and for our government to be subsidizing them until they do become standalone viable entities.
As you look at the opportunities here for health care reform, genuine health care reform, and you know what likely could be a watered-down result in terms of the final legislation that could be signed into law, do you feel that no health care reform at all this year might be a better result than having a watered-down plan that really doesn't change the current system all that much? Or would it be wiser for health care reform advocates to take advantage of whatever momentum we have here to get something passed at whatever cost?
I have to say that I think having nothing happen would be better than having a watered-down bill, because I know the way the spin works in Washington. They will spin a watered-down bill and make us think that it's comprehensive reform. And it may look that way for the first few years, but people have to understand that if this bill gets enacted, it won't even go into effect until 2013. Now, why do you think they don't want it to be actually operationalized until 2013? Well, that would be the year after the presidential reelection. There's so much more that goes into this than meets the eye. Now, there is, if they do pass a watered-down bill, there is one amendment that I hope remains in the final bill, and that would be Dennis Kucinich's amendment, which has made it so far through the Senate Help Committee. What Dennis Kucinich's bill would do is remove the barriers to individual states that want to enact single payer on a statewide basis, so that it creates waivers for the Medicare and Medicaid monies and some barriers through ERISA, which gets into a whole level of policy that I wouldn't begin to be able to explain. I just know that the ERISA legislation has been used as a way to prevent states from enacting single payer and coming up with a way of financing it.
That was Dr. Carol Paris, psychiatrist and member of Physicians for a National Health Program. Contact the group by calling area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at pnhp.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at detailonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.